Welcome back to Plastic Surgery Decoded, the podcast where we demystify plastic surgery and provide a foundation for understanding it, whether you're actually considering a procedure or you're just curious. As always, I'm your host, Dr. Regina Newhan, and in this season number 4, you'll find a new approach, including interviews and covering a wide variety of subjects. But after you listen to this episode, I encourage you to go back and really explore the previous seasons, as they are full of valuable information. You get to pick and choose what to learn about next. Season 1 covers common aesthetic or cosmetic surgery topics and skincare, while Season 2 explains reconstructive surgery topics. Then Season 3 goes over general questions about plastic surgery. Remember that this podcast reflects my experience and opinion, as well as those of any guest interviewed. It is not intended to provide medical advice, nor is it a substitute for a formal consultation with your physician. So stay tuned for this interesting journey we'll take together in the ever-expanding world of plastic surgery. Let's go! Okay, so you've lost weight, whether it's been through traditional means like diet and exercise, or through weight loss surgery, or even the new drugs available like Ozempic. But after going through that lengthy process, what you may not realize is that your stretched out skin will not necessarily shrink back. And if you've lost a large amount of weight, you may be left with sagging folds of skin in undesirable places that can really impact you both physically and mentally. You've done the work, so to speak, but you can't fully enjoy the results. Aha! This is where the plastic surgeon's role comes into play. It's amazing what can be done to recontour the body, to restore the shape you once had or that you desire. Curious about that? Well, then it's perfect that we have Dr. Brian Derby with us in conversation about this very topic. He's got some great explanations of what the options are and what best practices should be for patients in this situation. He imparts important information all throughout this episode, even to the very last bit. So let's join that conversation right now. Well, I'm here today with Dr. Brian Derby, who is a plastic surgeon in private practice in Sarasota, Florida. Now, he trained at the Southern Illinois University in plastic surgery, and then he did two different cosmetic fellowships, one with Dr. Jim Grotting and one with Dr. Mark Cardner, who are both big names in the plastic surgery world. Welcome, Dr. Derby.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate being here, Regina.
Yeah, you're so welcome. Well, you know, let's start with how you got interested in plastic surgery. Could you tell us that?
I can, yeah. I find this story is relatable to patients when I do share it, because my origins aren't really that of plastic surgery. They were more of, I wanted to play baseball for a living.
I love this.
And it was in college that the coach at the time sat me down when I was trying to walk onto the team, which was quite good. And he said, you know, Brian, if you have the opportunity to go to medical school, I don't get the opportunity to tell many athletes this, but you should do it.
Oh, so, yeah.
It was a very, it was a formative moment for me, because it was a slam door. But, you know, sometimes you need those doors to be slammed, and you need to do some deep thinking and move on.
Sure.
I pivoted into medicine. I thought maybe I'd become an orthopedic surgeon. It just seemed like a natural transition as an athlete. And then it wasn't until the later part of my medical training that I said, you know, I was watching a breast reconstruction case, and it was a muscle being moved from the back to the front. And I thought it was incredibly cool, and I was smitten from there.
Yeah.
I'm going into plastic surgery, and that's what I'm going to do.
Well, tell us about your current practice and the types of cases you typically do.
So over 9 years now, the practice has transitioned to strictly cosmetic surgery. So the majority of my time, I spend operating on the eyelids, faces, you know, for facelifting, and some iteration of breast augmentation with or without a lift, and tummy tucks. Those are the big, I'd say, 4 or 5 things that keep me the most busy day in and day out. And for that, I'm very grateful.
Yeah.
So it's strictly cosmetic. And today's topic is all about body contouring after weight loss, which works itself into my practice every week. And as you know, any one of those areas can be touched by patients who have lost a tremendous amount of weight. And each one of those areas, you're dealing with skin. So it melds very nicely with my practice, body contouring after weight loss.
Well, that's wonderful. And I'm just curious if over this last couple of years even, you've seen an increase in patient consultations with the advent of semaglutide drugs like Ozempic. Have you seen more requests for body recontouring after weight loss?
Yes, I would say it. I feel like it's really picked up maybe for me in the last year and a half. You know, the commercials are obviously all over the evening news, you know, for Ozempic, et cetera. But so many people have gained access to it. So many people are talking about it online as a way to effectively and honestly quickly lose weight. And, you know, as opposed to the, you know, tried and true energy in versus energy out way of doing things. I do see a lot of patients coming in talking about those medications. And I do think people need to be cautious about, you know, where these they're getting these medications because they're so accessible. That you really need to make sure you are being overlooked and prescribed by somebody in the medical field who really knows what they're doing, that it's not just somebody who, let's say, is a dentist or, a podiatrist, or with all due respect to the specialties, you really need somebody who understands the human body and the intricacies and the glands that can be affected by these medications. But I have seen a lot more people. And in fact, in the last couple of weeks, a couple of tummy tucks and a couple of breast lifts on account of Ozempic, you know, or roughly 30 to 60 pounds of weight loss for each patient, respectively.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Well, those are some important points that you make about the drugs themselves. But yes, we're here to talk about what happens after weight loss, whether it is through drugs or just good old hard work, you know, diet and exercise. And we want to talk about how a plastic surgeon may be able to help someone after they've gone through that process of losing a fair amount of weight. But could you at least start us off by explaining what can happen to body contour and to the skin of someone when they lose weight, regardless of the method?
Sure. Yeah, it's a really big deal for a guy or a gal to lose a lot of weight. You know, A, just the new lease on life that they get, the mobility, you know, joints are moving better, you know, backs are less achy.
Yes.
Medications are stopped, blood pressure medications, diabetic medications. So it's a tremendous boost in confidence in that respect for those patients, but they come in because their confidence really isn't there. Mm. So they have this internal sense of well-being that the weight loss has created, be it through, you know, bariatric surgery or medications, as you said, or good old-fashioned diet and exercise, but they're just not complete. And so that's really one of the first things I notice when people walk in the doors. We talk about the emotion of the weight loss. Yeah. When they look in the mirror and say, I still look 300 pounds to me, or I still look 250 pounds.
Yeah.
And I know I'm not, but I still am. So that to me is kind of the key piece to really grapple with the patient is to say, you know, heck, you've been through a lot of work here. This was a tremendous accomplishment. I'm here to help you. I'm going to get you through this. We're going to tune things up here, there, everywhere to your heart's desire. But I will just acknowledge for people listening that, you know, if you are going to lose a tremendous amount of weight, make sure you do have a good support structure and that when you do seek counsel.
That's very good.
You know, from a plastic surgeon that you're with somebody that you can really, really relate to and really empathizes with the emotions that you're going through. Because I can easily talk about how to do things and how to cut things off and make things look pretty. But man, it's a long walk for a lot of these folks going through this surgery. And it's because of, you know, the pleats and the folds and the sags and the bags that quite literally touch every aspect of their body. You know, like I said, you know, keeps me very busy, you know, with eyelids and facelifts in this population. Their breasts are just deflated. You know, the skin creates an overhang. For the novice listener, it's something called a pannus, P-A-N-N-U-S.
Like an apron.
Like an apron, exactly like an apron. Yeah. It just gets in the way.
Yeah.
It's something that I hear people very candidly, once we break the ice in the consultation, talk about. It even inhibits them sexually. Mm-hmm. You know, it's embarrassing, I hear quite frequently.
Not comfortable in their own bodies. Yeah.
Right, just not comfortable in their own skin, exactly, their bodies. So. Yeah. All those areas become kind of saggy and baggy, and there's ways to help them. That's why we're here to talk more about it.
Yeah.
But that's usually what I see. So you kind of pair the emotion with the physical, and that's how they present.
I think that's really important because I think a lot of people don't even fathom that there can be a psychological component to this. You know, as you say, the weight loss is exciting, and there's a little bit of a feeling of new lease on life, but then they're left with all this stuff, and, you know, how do they deal with that? And I do think people assume that once the fat underneath the skin has been reduced, that the skin would just automatically shrink back to the way it was before weight gain. But that's not the case necessarily, is it?
It's not. It's really not. When you think about our skin, it's the largest organ in the body, but it's also not meant to be stretched beyond its normal metrics. You know, there's forces and tensions when you stretch things, and eventually they give way. And for a lot of people, and certainly pregnant moms know this, you know, better than anybody, as far as their abdominal wall muscles and their abdominal wall skin and how that can change. But stretch marks are irreversible stretching. You know, mm-hmm. when you gain weight and you're, you know, quite a plus size, I mean, stretch marks show up everywhere. So you can deflate to your heart's content, but much like a slinky that's been slunk, it just doesn't rebound.
The slinky that's been slunk. I love that.
Yeah, it's been slunk out.
Yeah, and so, right.
And so it'd be exceedingly rare to lose, you know, plus 50, plus 60 pounds of weight and see any area of the body snap back because of stretch marks.
Yeah.
It's just irreversible skin injury.
That's an excellent way to put it, actually. It is irreversible. You know, it may seem to contract a little bit just because of physics, but it's really not going to ever be the way it was. So mm-mm. That's great. And then there are people who wonder, well, hey, can I just exercise more to correct the problem? What do you tell them when they say that to you?
Well, I encourage them. They've had this journey. They've created a wonderful lifestyle for themselves from a health standpoint, so I never discourage them from changing that ball game. But I do let them know that there's no way to contract down skin. You can certainly build up bulk and in muscular tone, and it's a lot of fun to encourage patients. However, it is really important for them to realize that, you know, the helium balloon, you know, once the helium's all out of it, the fat's all out of it, and same idea with the stretch marks, it's not going back. Mm. And it is fun to see patients come to see me, especially when perhaps they're not quite ready for surgery, be it that we're just not optimized in terms of health. And I'm going to give them a 6-month checkup to see where we're at. And they're like, hey, you know, Dr. Derby, look at my guns, look at my arms. I'm like, wow, that is incredible muscle mass. Now it's time for, you know, removal of that skin along your arm crease and really to help you out. So yeah, skin will never work itself out. Yeah. There's no laser, no cream, no anything when we're talking about large quantities of skin on the tummy and the breast that's ever going to rebound the way it does with surgery.
So to reinforce that, you know, people can work out and they can build up their muscle mass. That might fill up a little bit of skin, but it's really not going to be to the level where the skin seems taut again.
Exactly.
All right. Well, we're going to go into a little bit more about the surgical options to try to help people with recontouring. But you just alluded to this. Are there some non-surgical treatments that can help, or do they help a little bit? What are those options and what could they do?
I think in the clientele that is a massive weight loss patient, there are no non-surgical options that fit the bill. For the listeners that are not in that spectrum of patient, but have lost a little bit of weight and do see a little bit of loose skin, let's say on a hip or a lower abdomen, there are non-surgical options available for them that usually involve some iteration of microneedling or penetrating the skin, et cetera, to try to stimulate collagen growth through controlled trauma. Basically it's controlled trauma when you administer these treatments to the skin, and they're designed to tighten skin, but that would be in a clientele quite different.
Yeah, they just do a little bit of tightening, don't they? Whether it's through mechanical trauma, as you say, or heating up the skin or something like that.
Exactly.
That can give you a little contraction, but unfortunately, there's a lot of hype out there making people think that, oh, that'll just take care of the problem. And it's really just a
drop in the bucket. I couldn't agree with you more, Janet.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a drop in the bucket. Yeah, it's available for those that just don't want surgery and want something done. So,
yeah. Well, let's get into a little more detail about these surgical options. And first of all, could you explain for the listeners the body areas, the kind of segments where you most commonly get requests for recontouring after weight loss?
Yeah, absolutely. So it would be, you know, from the neck up, obviously we're talking about eyelids, necks, jawlines, cheeks. That's one section that's usually worked out at one time point. We'll get into likely a discussion of sequencing these operations in a minute here. But,
and, you know, let me say that that's interesting because I think a lot of people assume that it's just going to be their body that has all this extra skin, and they don't think about the face, do they?
No, they certainly don't. I mean, it's, I think, hit mainstream now, so-called Ozempic face.
Yes.
Which
we did a little episode on that, yeah.
Oh yeah, that's right, you did. Ozempic face. So it's hit mainstream, I think, media, and it passes so quickly on social media as a result. People are so much more aware of this concept. But anytime there's volume loss, certainly the face is going to be affected. You know, it's something people somewhat, like you said, are a bit surprised when they inquire, is there any interest in anything from the neck up? And if there's not, certainly I don't push the issue. But they're like, huh, I never really thought about that.
Yeah.
And so, so neck up would be one area. And then I work the trunk. So there's the front. The trunk would be our core, you know, our chest and our tummy. And you work that in two approaches, you know, work on the chest, work on the tummy. You could do those at the same time or separate. And then when you look at the back side of the trunk, you're thinking of the upper back. This would be the so-called bat wing area, that people, scapular roll is the formal term, but that they're not aware of when they want their back lifted. That's what we're talking about, is skin on the upper back. Mm-hmm. And the flanks as well, in conjunction with the buttock region, are addressed kind of in one fell swoop. So I always think neck up, trunk, front trunk, back trunk, and then we talk about extremities, be it the arms or the thighs.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
That's how I group it.
That's wonderful. And in patients who have had a significant amount of weight loss, are you planning to treat more than one body part? And how do you sequence that, or how do you structure that?
It's a very important point, primarily because of safety concerns with respect to surgical duration and opposing forces. So whenever we as plastic surgeons are planning, paramount is safety.
Yes.
And so duration on the operating room table is really an important thing, as I'm thinking about how efficiently can these two hands treat a part of the body or two parts of the body. I have to think, you know, anything beyond 4, 5, 6 hours is very risky for the patient in terms of what could happen and go wrong during surgery. Mm-hmm. So firstly, it's how much can be accomplished within 4 to 6 hours tops. So that's rule number one. And that boils down to patient safety, which is paramount. Rule number two for me is to address in sequence, what's their top issue?
Yes. Yeah.
So what's number one for you? Maybe for them, it's their thighs.
Yeah.
You know, what's number two for you? Maybe for them, it's their eyelids. So I always sequence it in a way that addresses their issues first. And we come up with that wish list, if you will, that kind of a la carte menu.
That patient satisfaction, especially if they have financial concerns, they just can't afford to do everything.
Oh, no question.
They're going to want to focus on the things that are most problematic to them.
Yep, and that's point two, is what does the patient want? And point three, as I get the list, which I frequently get a list, you know, from patients, then I start to group them into what makes sense from a standpoint of it's grouped together. And I kind of alluded to this a minute ago, but it's very common to work on the breasts or the chest in the man. You know, men struggle with this too.
Men need it too, yes.
Men
they have all that extra breast skin.
Absolutely. It's not just women that seek chest contour improvement because of deflated breasts. Deflated chests on men are a big issue, and that can be addressed in conjunction with the abdominal wall or the skin, the tummy, at the same time. And that usually does it for me. I'll do two majors, and that I consider those to be two majors.
Got it.
A minor would be like maybe adding upper eyelids, but I usually stick to two major zones, and that's it. I call it quits at that point because it's not safe for the patient. So chest and tummies, backs pair well together. I find I can sequence the bra line into the arm very nicely after the breasts have been completed. Mm. So there's recipes to group it together that I think just makes sense.
Yeah, well, it's a great way to approach it. Well, let's go back a little bit and just talk about some of those body areas. I think, you know, people probably understand pretty easily that the breasts do get deflated and they may need, you know, something to restore volume in addition to skin contour. So you could speak about that. But I think people don't really think about the back at all.
Mm-hmm.
They think about the buttock area sometimes, but, you know, the back is an interesting spot that maybe is an afterthought for some people, but there's just all this stuff that accumulates back there. So why don't you talk about circumferentially the trunk and what you can accomplish?
Sure. So I think that's a great point about volume. And this population, to me, I treat a little differently than my postpartum request for breast volume restorations. In this population, going back to what we said, the stretch marks are irreversible skin damage. And I kind of look at stretch marks as the tip of the iceberg because, yeah, the skin is loose. But if I see tons of stretch marks, I know the tissue is going to be loose.
Yes.
And so when you're thinking about restoring volume in somebody, and namely with breast implants would be the most common technique utilized to date. If you're gonna put a breast implant in somebody who has this sort of stretchiness to their tissue, you have to be really conservative with size selection, in my humble opinion, or think about adding in a supportive structure, mesh is the common term that we use, or frankly, where I've gone very commonly now, I've pivoted in my practice, is to addressing the breasts in two stages now with this particular population.
Yeah.
The most important procedure for them is getting their breasts off of their tummy and out of their armpit when they lie down.
Yeah.
That's point one. And quite frequently, when I do that and we get the breast to sit on its proper location on the chest wall, they're just elated. to be able to put a t-shirt on and not have to fight with them in a bra and all the things that go wrong.
Gosh.
And when you can do that and get that situated, wait 6 to 12 months. Frequently the conversation is, you know, I'm happy with what I've got, Dr. Derby. Ah. I don't need that volume.
Good job.
And so I think just patience and thinking logistically and asking your plastic surgeon, do I have to put an implant? My immediate response is always no.
Yeah.
You do not have to. The important procedure is getting your breast attuned up.
I think that's an excellent point about, you know, the people who do come in and want an implant, realizing that there's not going to be the typical supporting tissues there that were once there. You know, all that stuff is just permanently stretched out. And if you don't want a rock and a sock, you know, and to put it bluntly,
exactly right.
You really have to have, if you're going to do an implant, you have to do other internal support. And I think that's really an excellent point.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, there's just so many layers to that onion of the breast that you need to talk about with patients. And I ask that these sorts of folks that when they're going to see counsel, they say, okay, really explain this breast lifting thing to me. Is that going to be the like most important part of this deal? Or do I really need that implant? Because not that I'm opposed to implants, but I do know it does open up another can of worms when things start to shift out of place and patients are dissatisfied because the implant's in their armpit, et cetera. And then you have to go right back in and support the structure if you don't preemptively strike with putting some mesh in the breast to support those implants right off the bat. But it's, I don't want to get too detailed here
and confuse
people, but it's suffice to say you can stage one thing at a time. Goes a long way in surgery, in my opinion.
Yeah, nice approach.
So that would be with the breasts. And people frequently ask me about fat transfer. And I think it's a prudent point just to mention to people where you suck fat out of one part of the body and you're thinking about volume restoration in the breast with that fat. My short take-home points on that for listeners are, you know, fat is not predictable. It's not an object that you put in and you get pound for pound what you expect out of an implant. Fat is not predictable. It does not project the way that an implant does. So if you're seeking a lot of upper breast fullness or roundness or that, you know, that appeal, in my humble opinion, you're not going to get it with fat. And furthermore, 1 in 10 patients will get a little oil cyst that is somewhat a bit disconcerting. An oil cyst would just be a ball of oil in the breast after fat transfer. Because
kind of liquefied fat,
Liquefied fat, not all of it makes it. And that's an important thing, you know, that it can lead to subsequent exams and ultrasounds and needle biopsies, et cetera, that concern patients when you have a lump in your breast, understandably.
Sure.
So it's not that I'm opposed to fat grafting. I use it all the time in the face for volume restoration and putting things back where they belong. But in the breast, I think, you know, just be very mindful that it to me, it's an underwhelming result. Mm-hmm. Certain people love it. I just have found in my own practice that it's underwhelming. So something to talk about.
It's good insight. You know, we talk about tummy tuck and people assume that, okay, I'm going to have all this extra tummy skin. I could get a tummy tuck. But it's a little different, isn't it, than someone who's had a few babies and has this extra stuff in front. You know, when you have the massive weight loss, you don't just have it in the front. It kind of circles all the way around to the back. So how do you address that with patients?
Yes. So I love staging. I love doing things in sequence. And so the so-called circumferential body lift or belt lipectomy, basically in simple terms, around the world skin removal. So front to back, side to side, think of the trunk like a donut and you're peeling that donut completely out of the trunk and you're pulling the skin back together, literally 360 degrees around the human body. Mm-hmm. You can make a dramatic change for patients, don't get me wrong, but remember what I said, you know, two majors at a time. That's two majors. That's basically a tummy tuck, a hip lift, and a gluteal or a butt lift all in one fell swoop. It's a big deal. And to me, when you're thinking about tension and forces, with patients getting tummy tucks, you're pulling them forward. Mm-hmm. With patients getting lower back tightening and butt lifting at the same, you're pulling them backwards. So I find that if I'm going to do that and look at that body 360 degrees, that I'll do the tummy tuck first with a clear understanding that we're going to have a transition zone that's going to be suboptimal for a couple of months. But we are planning to lift the rear end and tighten up the hips at the same time. That's my personal opinion and approach to things. There's 1,000 ways to skin a cat in our field, as you know.
Of course.
But that is what I find just logistically makes most sense to me, is to do the tummy and then address the rear end. And to your point about massive weight loss patients, if you think of the apron we referred to earlier in the conversation, you know, it can be loose up and down, and it can be loose left and right.
Right. right. Side to side. Yeah.
Side to side. You can pull your shirt up, you can pull your shirt down, and then you can move it side to side if it's really loose. Same concept, you know, applies to looking at the skin. You tailor it. You know, I think of us as glorified skin tailors sometimes, plastic surgeons, very well educated and trained skin tailors. But I do think that not every patient who you do a horizontal, meaning along the, you know, the bikini line tummy tuck, is going to get a fantastic result because of that looseness left to right.
Yeah.
And when they lean over, they're still going to see that kind of teepee effect of the skin falling forward, just as it would after, you know, you lost the weight and you're looking down and you lean forward and you see that sagging going forward.
Yeah, like, what's this?
What's this? And so that can be tightened up too, but that would be a vertical scar. And not every patient's open to that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a vertical scar that runs from just below the breastbone down to the pubic bone, which pairs very nicely and really offers a patient maximal skin removal. But not everybody's open to that very, you know, front and center scar.
Yeah, especially if they are bikini wearers and, you know, concerned about that. Sure, understandable. But the benefit that can come from that is sometimes worth the trade-off of switching to a one-piece.
So, it is.
Or just letting it all hang out.
Some days, why not? I think it's all in feeling the patient out, understanding their persona, understanding their emotion, understanding their level of, I don't care, Dr. Derby, just cut it all off, you know, ooh, I don't know if I'd like that. Then I say, don't do it. Don't do it.
That's wise. Well, now, what about the thighs? What are the problems and what can be done?
So the problems I hear the most about are the rubbing, the chafing of the skin along the inner thigh, most notably, again, tucking it in to bathing suits and trying to tuck it into jeans. And those are the things that are the common complaints from patients, and the ever desirable quote, thigh gap, end quote, is what I hear a lot about. Can you please, please, please give me a thigh gap?
Yeah.
That's a desire from some patients that just really sticks out in my mind.
Yeah.
So in thinking about the thighs, you got to think once again, just like a tailor, where does the seam of your pant lie? Usually it's on the inside of your thigh. So you got to think, you know, real basically here. And when you're mulling these options over as a patient, like, where's that seam going to be? And am I okay with that seam going from my knee to my groin? You know, that gives me the most tightening possible that I can offer to a patient. When I go from knee to groin, it really lets me treat the whole thigh like a loose pant. But I often will add a scar in the groin if I really want to get that thigh gap for the patient. And that's
kind of like along that crease.
Just along the crease. Yeah, think of a crescent moon. It'd be called a crescent thigh lift, but a crescent moon. And you can pair those operations together if I feel it's the right person with the right leg, with the right amount of skin laxity. I'll pair that groin crease incision with the vertical incision and really, you know, get a home run looking result for patients.
Yes.
Because it really gets the thigh gap. So I find that crease incision gets the thigh gap, but the seam incision, or the seam, you know, right down the inside of the thigh from knee to groin, gets the most tightening and biggest bang for their buck.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah, that's my opinion.
And then we touched on this a little bit, but what about arms? What are you finding with arms? What are the strategies there?
Yeah, patients will start with asking me, do I have to have that scar? And that's frequently the question. And like most things in life, when you explain it to them and understand the rationale, they come to accept it a little bit better. But arms are usually loose from armpit all the way down to the elbow, and quite honestly, even down to the wrist crease.
Yes.
And some patients need that addressed as well. But more commonly, people are going to end up with an incision that goes just behind the bicep. So when they hold their arm out to the side and they feel a little groove where their bicep is, just behind that is where the scar is going to set from elbow to armpit. And we can clean up that skin immensely, so that putting a strappy little dress on is so much more comfortable for these patients. Their arm caliber, their dimension, the width is so much smaller. And I think the best candidates for these particular procedure, again, have dripping skin. It's really loose, as opposed to very full arms. Those are a bit more of a challenging case.
Yeah.
With expectation management, really important to tell people you're not going to get that tight arm like you would if your skin was deflated, or if this fatty tissue was deflated more.
Yeah. And so just to clarify, if someone's in this cute little dress, no one's going to see that scar unless they, you know, what, put their arm over their head or, you know, something like that. And then you'd really even have to look at it because it can blend in pretty nicely.
It can blend in really nicely. And expectation management with this particular part of the body, I tell patients, you got to give me 12 to 18 months yes. in terms of scar. So just get used to, you know, picking that suntan lotion with the tint in it, or a little bit of cover-up makeup goes a long way.
It's a good idea.
But, you know, I say, and I'm frank with patients, I say, at first, I'm telling you, you're going to be like, what the heck? Because it does look like a zipper. But yeah. I'm telling you now, just to preface it, and make sure you realize what you're getting into. But when I show them the post-op results in comparable arms, they yeah. say, I'm still committed. So yeah. yes, when the arms are overhead, we can't make scars go away completely.
Right.
We're humans. We make scar. We're not amphibians. You know, we don't regenerate tails. We make scar.
If only.
If only. But I make that really clear to them. And another basic tip out there is that there's cosmetic tattooing, flesh tattooing that matches scars that goes a tremendously
yes.
long way. I've seen that
in my
own
practice.
That's
a great point. This is a yeah. really great point.
So great option for patients to seek if they're really bothered by a scar.
Yeah. And then lastly, let's talk about what you do the most. What can be done for the face? How do you like to stage it, or what order do you like to do things? And I know it depends on obviously what the patient needs and what they desire, but if they needed everything, what would you do?
Yeah, everything would imply my brow needs to come up, my upper eyelid skin needs to be removed, my lower eyelid bags need to be smoothed down, my cheek needs to be lifted, my jawline needs to be sharper, and my neck needs to look real crisp, and I need some volume back. That would be everything.
That's a lot. Yeah, that's yeah. The full deal.
Yeah, the way I approach this with patients is say, okay, here's everything you could benefit from. If we're going to pare this into parts, I say, this is how I would do this. If we're not going to do it all in one fell swoop, I would start with your eyes or the cheeks with the neck, depending on what's more important to you. But in my opinion, when I look at people, I notice their eyes immediately. That may just be preferential. I love yeah. eyelid surgery. Trained with Mark Codner. He was a guru
yeah.
on eyelid. So I really love eyelids. It's an area of focus for me. However, I think when you focus on those eyelids, you just brighten up the appeal of a person's overall presentation so much.
Yeah, it's a great point.
They look rested. They look just regenerated. They look refreshed. Faces, which to me, to keep it simple for listeners, a face is a cheek plus a neck, okay? Because you hear it all the time. Are you getting a cheek lift, a neck lift, a facelift? My golly, there's so many things online. I really try to break this down simply. I say, look, if you're above the jawline, we're working on your cheek. If we're below the jawline, we're working on your neck. If I'm working on both, I'm working on your face. And so that
gotcha.
Clears it up quickly for patients, so they're not assuming, well, I'm going to get my brow up with a facelift.
Right.
Or I'm going to get my lower eyelids done with a facelift. No, these are separate zones.
Excellent
so
point.
If we do the whole thing, which can be done, one kit and caboodle, like I mentioned earlier on, from brow on down to the neck, we do that if the world's the patient's oyster. But I do tell patients, group the eyes and then do the cheek and neck at another date if we're looking to, make this a little bit easier on the budget.
Yeah, absolutely. And, as you say, you can get so much of a refreshed look from just doing the eyes that if they were borderline for other things, they may decide, I'm done. Or they may just stage it and come back later and have it, have the procedure at that point.
So exactly.
It's great.
Yeah. Very common.
Excellent. Well, I know we've talked about so many different types of procedures and they all vary, but in general, how long can some of these take, especially if you double up? Do you really cap it at 4 to 6 hours? Can they take a little longer than that? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I would say most breast cases are going to take your surgeon, in my opinion, around 3 hours. Big lifts, big reductions.
A lot of sewing.
A lot of sewing, as you know. So around 3 hours. Typical tummy is going to take 3 hours. So right there, I usually say we're done. If you want to add your upper eyelids for 30 minutes, let's do it. If you want to add your upper eyelids plus your lower eyelids, you're adding another hour. I can push the envelope a little bit, but I would say 6 is my average if I'm going to group things. Yeah, so I really try to hang my hat on that, just knowing you can do things another day and we've got a relationship that's going to be growing for years here. We don't have to knock it out in one fell swoop.
Yeah, and so just furthering that concept of, for years, someone comes in and they need a fair amount of work done, or they're desiring a fair amount, and you're going to stage things. What do you tell them to look at in the future in terms of how much of a time commitment this will be?
Yeah, it's a great question. With most people, I'm looking at two operations and sometimes three. So I'll tell people, for full rejuvenation after all this weight loss, if you're really looking to do the whole thing, again, if there's no limitation to what you and I can accomplish together, we're probably going to have a 2-year surgical relationship.
2 years, so, yeah.
Yeah, about a 2-year surgical relationship, because I'm going to do an operation, and I'm, to me, for the emotional support of the patient, the physical support of the patient, logistically just getting back in the flow, I'm going to tell them, you got to wait 4 to 6 months before we do anything else. I think it's prudent to do that so that people can just get their feet back up under them. I mean,
yeah.
You know, just get squared up with, you know, the change. Enjoy the change, you know, have fun with it. Enjoy the new contour, the compliments you get, the excitement. Let's come back and do something again at around month 6. Okay, we'll do that. And then you want to do another one? Fine. Let's wait another 6 months after that or so. And through recovery, et cetera, I'm going to be with that patient guaranteed for 1.5 to 2, for sure, just surgical recovery. Yeah. And it's not that they're in recovery mode, like they're bent over, et cetera.
Oh, of course.
It's just the follow-up, the frequent, you know, visits at first, and then the time periods that are allowed to pass for photographs to be documented so that we can enjoy the changes that we see together. It just takes time.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I would always tell my patients that your skin has been permanently changed. And even with the surgery, it doesn't necessarily stay shrink wrapped. And so I would tell them, you know, expect that we might have to do a little revision at some point. But what do you tell your patients?
That's I'm really glad you mentioned that, because that shows our humanity. Very candid right from the get go that, look, I could not agree with you more.
Yeah.
And I want you to understand, in your cat is, you know, that's what I say, in your category, to your point, with your skin laxity being what it is, it would be exceedingly common for us to come up and have to maybe touch up the position of that breast just a little bit more, but I'll pair that with your tummy, or I'll pair that with your arm for you. I'll pair that with your eyelids for you. So again, that you're absolutely right. That, you know, light bulb went off. What else goes into the recovery is touch-ups.
Yes.
And I just say, you know, I always tell patients, these are human hands, you know, I'm good, but I ain't God, you know, and I'll help you. But you got to let me help you, you know, through this. And so, revisions are an absolute honest part of the conversation. Yeah. I would encourage listeners, if you're considering this any of these operations, and you're in this category of patients, please make sure you ask your surgeon, if they don't divulge it immediately, you know, do revisions happen in your practice? Mm-hmm. And if he or she tells you no, then you're in the wrong practice, because that's just frankly not true.
Absolutely. You know, and we as surgeons can do so much, but the rest really is up to the patient's body, and we don't have control over that. We can try to anticipate it a little bit, but, you know, things are going to shift and change. And I love what you said, because I would do this too. You can fold that little revision into the next procedure that you're planning to do. And then it's a little easier for the patients to accept that, okay, I may have to have a little tweaking here and there, but we're coming back to do da 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 anyway. So let's just do it then. And it's perfect.
Yep, I love it. Yep.
Let me ask you a little bit about significant risks of these procedures. You know, each one has their own separate little risk, but just in general, when we're doing big procedures on patients and there's a lot of incision line or a lot of sewing, and there's a fair amount of time on the operating table, what do you think are the biggest risks that you try to anticipate and protect against?
Yep, I anticipate incision breakdown. A little baby eyelid incision is quite different than an extended incision along the abdominal wall that hooks around each hip and stops, you know, thereabouts. So we, as plastic surgeons, are always trying to create the best scar possible. And we know that it doesn't just happen, but we do it by closing all of our incisions in layers. And so to the layperson not familiar with what we're talking about, this is just from the inside out. As you get to the surface of the skin, you're putting in multiple, think of it like cornrows, multiple layers of incisions from the deep tissue, meaning well under the skin, you know, centimeter, 2-3 centimeters under skin, all the way up to the surface of the skin. So I'm anticipating wound breakdown and trying to avert it by having a very thorough, very nice closure and not taking too much skin.
Good point.
That's the other thing. You know, got to play by the rules with skin. If you take too much, you can't close. As we all know, you measure twice and cut once, measure 3 times, in fact, and cut once, so that you know whatever skin you're removing on a patient, you're not going to be taking too much. So I'm anticipating wound breakdown. and trying to avert it in that way. I'm anticipating the possibility of prolonged time on the table resulting in wet lungs. So I'm always encouraging patients after the operations to take deep breaths. We have a little toy for them to play with called a spirometer. But anyway, I'm anticipating avoiding pneumonia after these procedures, yeah, because they're on their back or their tummy for an extended period of time. You know, they're asleep. They're getting fluid into their veins to keep their blood pressure supported. We do that during every single surgery, and it inherently makes the lungs wet. So I really try to open up the spongy lungs. And I'm also very focused on avoiding blood clots in this clientele. And we have a tool. It's a wonderful tool that I use on every patient. It's called the Caprini scale. And I score every single patient.
That scale will assess risk of blood clots for a patient.
It will, yep. And it can give you a number. You can actually get the scale. It's online. Every plastic surgeon, I think, should use it. But we are doing that for you patients so that we can say, you know, it's really a good idea to add blood thinner to this patient after this operation.
Yeah.
It'll take their risk from, you know, 7% down to a more acceptable 1% or less. And some patients start out at less than 1%, but you can actually get that calculation to help guide your clinical judgment. And so I'm thinking of that with every body contouring operation.
Yeah. Okay. For the listeners, could you explain how a blood clot can even happen during a surgery? What's going on to make them at risk for a blood clot, and where does the clot typically occur?
Yeah, so when you're asleep on the operating room table, the anesthesiologist or anesthetist, they're giving you medications that relax your blood vessels. So it's not just relaxing you so that, you know, you're nice and still and that you're not moving around on the operating room table, but it's also relaxing the muscles that are in the blood vessel tubes. And so when those muscles relax, it's kind of like, well, blah. The blood just kind of stagnates because it's not, it doesn't move as well. It's not, doesn't have that internal pump going on. And so when the body's relaxed like that, when blood gets slow, it gets sticky. And as a result of that, you know, you can get a blood clot. Usually it'll show up with some discomfort, perhaps in the calf or the thigh, or swelling in the calf or the thigh. And that's something to watch out for. But that's really the nuts and bolts of it, is that the body tone is just gone. Now, we do put little squeezy boots on the calves to help mm-hmm. massage those areas we know that are prone to develop blood clots during operations. And they're universal in nearly every operation around the world on a daily basis. But that's the result of that just blah blood vessel not moving the blood up where it's supposed to because of the anesthesia.
That's a great explanation.
Good, yeah.
Well, are there some patient factors that can lead to a better or worse chance of success? Or are there some patients who are just not even a good candidate for surgery? What criteria do you look at?
Yeah, gosh, our journals are just replete, our articles, you know, so these scientific studies come out and they're put into journals for the listener. Journals are just basically magazines of scientific work that we read through.
And there's, keep us up to date.
Yeah, keep us up to date so, you know, we can stay current and make sure we're doing the right thing at all times for patients. But every one of these articles that comes out about body contouring always points to, you know, body mass index, which is a simple calculation. Anybody can Google their body mass or BMI online, which you do have to take somewhat with a grain of salt because it can be different how tall you are and how much you weigh, muscle mass, etc. But it's a general guideline, you know, that for folks who are in the obese category, meaning BMI over 30, that you're really asking for a problem for yourself if you're going to set and stay above 30 and go and have a tummy tuck with a, you know, Brazilian butt lift and a breast dog and a lift and a facelift all in one fell swoop. Now, not saying that it's that number of cases that's the problem, but the body mass index has been a very studied metric that we can share with patients and listeners. We can tell you it's really sharp to get it below 30. And I very frequently will tell patients, look, we got this great idea. This is a wonderful meeting. We got a relationship established. You know you're going to get a great outcome. You know we're going to do the right thing, but we're going to come back in 6 months and we're going to see where you're at with your lifestyle changes. And honestly, yes, coming full circle to what we're talking about in the beginning, I do refer now for consideration for semaglutide and say, hey, are you a good candidate? Because it's, and I, you know, have a practitioner that I know does a great job with those patients, advising them appropriately at how to dose this, that they can stay on track. And I don't know if this is true or not, but these sorts of medications may supplant bariatric surgery, or at least are probably competing with weight loss surgery.
Absolutely.
Significantly, because of the dramatic weight that people are losing on them. So firstly, BMI. Secondly, we can't have nicotine in our bodies, before or after surgery.
Good point.
It's well written up in our literature that if you're going to have an elective operation, you really should quit for a month before the operation. And I enforce to people, now don't go light up on day one after surgery either.
Right, exactly. You're still healing.
I'm frank with patients. And as you know, they appreciate that. So don't go lighting up. And thirdly, we got to have our blood sugar at a proper control level. So A1Cs have been studied extensively in our medical journals. And anything above 7 is just, you're asking for your incision to bust open.
Just won't heal.
It just won't heal. It's just not meant to heal right. So those are the big three.
So diabetics in particular need to really have everything under control. And that's a great point. Well, now what happens if someone does all these wonderful procedures, they've really recontoured their body with your help, they're loving life, but then they gain weight? What do you tell them to expect?
And I've had that happen. And it's very frustrating for a patient. It's an emotional major downer. And I think what to expect is, firstly, something's going on with you right now. What's going on? This is different than the person that I knew ready for surgery. This is different than the person who, went through surgery. This is different than the person that I saw at your last follow-up and you looked amazing. What else is going on? And just having that heart-to-heart, is something changing your personal life? Are you having any other symptoms that could be related to something that has yet to be diagnosed? Thyroid issues. I've had, one patient in particular stands out. Do we need to ask your medical doctor to take a closer peek at how your metabolism's doing? How are your hormones doing? But
that's interesting.
But
yeah.
I start there, and then I let them know, objectively, this has been stretched out. If it's your choice, we'll go ahead and tighten it up again, but I'm not going to do that before we get whatever's going on under control. So coming back again to saying, okay, what's going on? Have these personal conversations. Is it something with a relationship? Is it something, what's going on? So that's the sort of rapport that I think is important to establish so that we get to the root and don't just assume, well, they gain weight again. That's not the right thing.
Very good for people to know. So thank you. I know people are curious, does insurance ever cover these procedures to recontour the body after significant weight loss?
The black and white answer is no, with the asterisk being you may get help with skin removal of the abdominal wall, which is called a paniculectomy, meaning no muscle tightening. We're not talking about muscle tightening. We're talking about removal of skin only, the apron only. If rashes are a significant issue, if you've been on multiple bouts of antibiotics and had issues with use of creams or necessitating creams to help get rid of these rashes, that would be the only area that I have seen insurance lending a hand, because they actually have a code for what's called a paniculectomy, and that would be about it. But brachioplasty, thighplasty, all these fancy words that just mean arm skin removal, leg skin removal, or breast lift, which is a mastopexy, those sorts of things, just unfortunately, insurance does not support. Breast reduction, which is another word for a big breast lift for listeners, it's the same thing, it's the same technique, it's just a lot of tissue comes out. Therein may also be an opportunity for insurance to help and assist you, but that would have to be with a provider who is contracted with either the agencies in your area or has a Medicare number. So those would be the two areas that you might get some help.
It's good for people to know, I think, in advance as they embark on the possibilities of what might be done for them. So
absolutely.
Great. Well, I'd just love it if you had any patient stories that you could share that might illustrate the impact that body recontouring after weight loss can have on restoring quality of life.
I'd have to say,
besides everybody.
Yeah, right. It's such a tremendous dramatic change. I will say this, population of patients, there's more tears after surgery than any other patient population. There's happy patients that you do their eyelids, there's happy patients that you do their facelift, there's happy patients that you do their breast aug and their breast lift and tummy tuck, etc. But there are just like emotional highs, from this that are they're like second to none as far as the tears, because as they tell you what it was like to put that bathing suit on that they never thought they'd put on again, or they tell you that their husband looked at him and just was like, they couldn't take their eyes off him, and vice versa, the wife couldn't take her eyes off him. Just like, and you know offers them a compliment that says like, honey, you look amazing. You know, those sorts of things are, which is why I love doing this work, because to hear patients and to hear them sharing with tears of joy what a difference this made in their life. I mean, as you say, it's most of them, you know, that feel that way.
Oh, it's so wonderful.
It's such a wonderful gift that we get to give to people, and we're so lucky to be able to do it.
I love that. Yes. Well, any final thoughts you'd like to share with the listeners, either about this topic or just about plastic surgery in general?
Yeah, I'm a big advocate for education of self. And I really would ask listeners, you don't just do your homework on Google, you know, when it comes to selecting a surgeon. This is such important work. There's a lot at stake in terms of health. There's a lot at stake in terms of outcome. There's a financial tremendous commitment that you'll make. When you are seeking counsel, it's hard to sometimes find if you're in the hands of somebody who really is credentialed to do the work that we're doing. You know, I know there's lots of people that will go to 6 months or 12 months in training in cosmetic surgery, but the prior 5, 6, 7 years they were doing general surgery or neurosurgery or obstetrics or family medicine or pediatrics, and somehow, some way decided that they would enter the world of plastic surgery because it looks cool, it sounds fun, it is rewarding.
And it's lucrative.
And so there's a lot of folks out there that are willing to do that, listeners, and they didn't go through 5, 6 years of plastic surgical training to be able to sit in front of you and call themselves a real plastic surgeon. And it's very frequently dubbed, when you look online, individuals will label themselves as cosmetic surgeons. They won't use the phrase plastic surgeon because they're not actually supposed to, and certainly our American Board of Plastic Surgery would be all over that if folks were dubbing themselves plastic surgeons that weren't. But it's easy, if you can look at a Google search and say cosmetic surgeons in my area, to have a very blended makeup of actual plastic surgeons and people who may have been a dentist, you know, the year prior. So it's my ask to educate yourself. And quite simply, if you're ever in question and ever want to know if your plastic surgeon is the real deal, just Googling the American Board of Plastic Surgery and checking, is this person a member of that society, will tell you immediately whether or not this is a real plastic surgeon with real training in the art of plastic surgery. So please don't be duped or, you know, oh, never mind those real plastic surgeons, I can do this tummy tuck for you, no problem. Mm-hmm. There's a reason that we are here and that we have the privilege that we do. So please make sure you're in the proper hands.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Brian Derby, thank you so much for sharing some time with us and your expertise. I really think you gave people some great information that can help them process what they might be interested in the future. And if they do go for a consultation, they'll be armed with better information and probably be able to ask better questions as well. So thank you for being here.
Oh, it's just been delightful. And I want to acknowledge you, Regina. You really, our entire field of plastic surgery should acknowledge you. You're doing such a classy, professional job of selecting folks to talk about these topics and share it with the public. And I can't thank you enough for the work you're doing as a labor of love, as you said.
Yeah.
You really are doing the specialty and the world of listeners a tremendous service. So I am very proud to know you.
Thank you.
Proud to be part of your podcast, and I really consider this an absolute pleasure. So thank you for having me.
You're a delight. Thank you. Take care.
Take care.
Well, that's our show for today. Hope you enjoyed it and learned something too. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. Please share this podcast with someone else who might be interested. And while you're at it, check out the podcast website for related topics to explore. It's www.plasticsurgerydecoded.com. And as always, thank you for listening to Plastic Surgery Decoded.